Well, I'm gonna tell you, I enjoyed the book. I flew through it in about like two or
Okay.
three days. I really flew through it, and it was really, really, really fascinating. I think it's a lot more like your Mysteries in the Mist book.
Yeah, I mean, I see it as being a little bit different from just about anything else that I've written, because it's not so much of a case book as it is, though there's lots of case work in it, as it's more of a think piece. Because the whole idea, I mean, I'm sure you know, I ended up several times discussing this idea with Soraya on Where Did the Road Go? And I, after Sasquatch Canada was done and I'd gone through the whole publicity tour for that, I decided that I was gonna run with that and see. I talked to Soraya, I talked to Tim Renner and Joshua Cutchin, those guys who kind of formed the core of the people that I think had kind of the original idea. And they were all like, yeah, cool, write a book. I had no idea what a rabbit hole I was getting down when I started researching poltergeists.
Yeah, it's a big
So
subject.
it's a huge, huge subject. And I try when I am doing a book to keep it fairly concise. And I may have overdone it on this book, because there was so much stuff that I could have included, that it could have easily been, a two-volume set. But that's not what I was trying to do. So,
Concise is good to get your point across.
I worried that maybe I was a little too concise this time, but everybody that's read it has said they've enjoyed it. So,
I did. I
I haven't
really enjoyed it.
actually looked. Yeah, I haven't actually looked at the Amazon book reviews. I try not to do that very often, because people can be a little strange. It's like, my book didn't get here in time, and it must be your problem. It's like, no, I didn't have
Well,
anything to
I would
do
have
with it.
loved the book if it got here on time, but I said it would.
People can be a little, people can be a little weird. I had a review for, I think it was Canadian Monsters and Mysteries, but it might have been Mysteries in the Mist, where the person said, I knew I was going to hate this book as soon as I found out that he was citing stuff from Skinwalker Ranch, because that's all just a big scam. Okay, but there were literally hundreds of other cases in that book that you could have looked at.
Well, here's the meta of that, right? Skinwalker Ranch could still be a big scam and still have paranormal activity. That's
Exactly.
the meta on that.
Absolutely. I mean, there could be an element of, well, you see this in poltergeist cases too. There could be an element of fraud happening in the case, but there's still a poltergeist. There's still activity.
Well, Enfield was a good example of that, because the girls actually admitted to faking some of that. But what it did was like it primed the pump to where actual activity would start to like pop off. Like they had to get
Absolutely.
it started, essentially.
You throw something down on the floor, and all of a sudden everything goes bat crap crazy, and whether it's Enfield or the Black Monk case that I cite pretty extensively in the book, or whatever, there is often in these cases an element of, somebody helping things along. But then you have cases like Olive Hill, which is another one I talk about. William Rolls, very well-known parapsychologist, actually was walking into the kitchen with, was actually walking into the kitchen with this kid who was the focus of this activity, and watched the table in the dining room flip itself up and land on top of the dining room chairs. I mean, that just, there was no explaining that one. It's not like the kid could have run over there and flipped the table and then run back while he wasn't looking, or that the kid had the strength to do that. So, yeah. But anyway, I started doing research on the poltergeist stuff, and then I had to balance it out with the Sasquatch stuff, and it just, it was a lot. And I really, like I said, tried to keep it as concise as I could without, while still providing enough information and bibliographical information and that kind of stuff to get people going, which is really my purpose. Is it's like I want people to look at things at my books and say, oh, I find this really interesting, and then be able to go to the bibliography and look books up and say, oh, well, here's some other stuff I can read, which will lead them to other stuff that they can read, which,
Yeah.
it's neither here nor there. So, anywho, it got really interesting really quick, and I really had no idea. I mean, I did have an idea of the depth of psychical research, but after doing the research for this book, I've come to a whole new respect for those folks.
Sure.
Because they're just, yeah, I mean, it takes a certain amount of intestinal fortitude, I guess, to walk into a situation where there's just all kinds of crazy things going on, whether it's, things flying through the air, or the crockery shattering in the house, or, raps and bangs, or, people being pinned under furniture, or heavy furniture moving around. It's potentially dangerous, and at
Oh,
least one of the cases that I, and at least one of the cases that I cite in the book, a photographer who was in taking pictures actually got dinged in the head with a Lego, which left a bruise that was evident, a week later. So, it doesn't seem like people end up getting seriously injured in these events, but the potential is there.
yeah.
Because there's a lot of power flying around in these incidents, and all it takes is, is a matter of somebody stepping into the wrong path at the wrong time, and it could turn nasty real quick.
Right,
And
because these are the most physical
yep.
of
Oh
any of the
yeah.
phenomena.
Yeah, I
Well,
mean, there's a certain amount of physical activity in a lot of hauntings, and I cite some of that stuff in the book too. But it's really, the poltergeist takes it to whole new level. So I guess we should probably back up and talk about, what
that's a
this
good
has to do
start,
with
though. I
spirit.
think let's get started.
We already know each other and hit it off pretty
Oh
well,
yeah.
so
By
guys,
the way, good to see you guys.
yeah, good to see you
How's everyone
too.
doing?
Just to let everybody know, welcome to Conspiranormal. We're back after a little hiatus over the holidays, and
Hope
it
you all
is now
have a good one.
2024, and we have the first guest of the year, which is W.T. Watson, also known as Travis Watson. And we are just sitting here talking about poltergeists, which is something we're going to be talking about tonight because he has a new book out called The Forest Poltergeist. And
Yeah.
I think where I really want to start, Travis, is your motivation to write this particular book. What made you want to write a book about the forest poltergeist, which is an intriguing idea?
I had just finished Sasquatch Canada, and which, by the way, has been my best-selling book,
Excellent.
according to, all the stuff. I mean, I'm not going to retire or anything, but it's done fairly well. And
Has it sold better in Canada than as opposed to the United States, or is it
I
more?
can't tell. I can't
You
tell
can't tell that. Yeah.
from the reports that I get. I just can tell that overall it's gotten more sales, more page reads, and all that kind of stuff than any of my other books. But it seems to that my other books are coattailing off of that, which is very nice. And other people are discovering some of my other work, which makes me happy. Because I mean, you don't write books unless you want people to read them, right? So I had just gotten done with Sasquatch Canada, and I had played that book very, here's the evidence for Sasquatches, people seeing Sasquatches in Canada. I had decided not to include British Columbia because it's such a hotbed of activity. You could write a whole book, write a, just about British Columbian Sasquatch, right? And I'm sure somebody has. I wanted to see if there were if there was evidence of these entities, whatever they are, in the other provinces in Canada. And during the course of my research, I discovered that yes, indeed, there were. I found Sasquatch reports in every province in Canada except Nunavut. And that may simply be because there just aren't a whole lot of people in Nunavut. The vast majority of them are indigenous people, and they may or may not be willing to discuss their sightings if they've had them. But everywhere else, there are Sasquatch reports in Canada. So I focused in Sasquatch Canada on what the BFRO calls a Class A report. In other words, some guy's walking through the woods, or some person is walking through the woods, or, they're driving down the road or whatever, and they see a Sasquatch.
Right.
It's a Class A sighting. There's a visual sighting of a creature. But if you go into BFRO and other databases online, there's a good one out of Alberta, on the Canadian side. There are also a lot of reports of disturbances in the forests that are credited to Sasquatch. People assume that because certain things happen, in the woods, there's a Sasquatch nearby. People who've watched the shows or whatever are probably very aware of this. Things like wood knocks, stone throwing, vocalizations, tracks, nests, and I'm sure I'm forgetting something in there. But so there's all of this sort of disturbance out in the woods, but there's no actual sighting of a Sasquatch. And BFRO refers to these as Class B encounters. They take it as being evidentiary that there was a Sasquatch somewhere in the area, but nobody saw it. Well, I mean, you guys both know Soraya, from Where Did the Road Go? And,
Absolutely.
he's posited on any number of occasions that if you took all the stuff that people are crediting to Sasquatch in the woods and you put it in a house, you'd have a poltergeist case. And that idea stuck with me. And after conferring with, several people and making sure that they were not writing a book of their own, I went ahead and started work on the Forest Poltergeist, which is about Class B encounters, those encounters that people have in the forest where they don't actually see a Sasquatch, see a creature, but there is a disturbance in the woods. And I started to look at that, and I started to look at the idea of poltergeists, and then I took the two and put them together and found that, that it's absolutely the case that we could explain these disturbances in the woods where nobody sees anything, as some form of force, which we'll call a poltergeist for want of a better word, operant out in the woods. Because you can take every single one of the things that people assign to be evidence of Sasquatch in the woods and find an activity in the poltergeist lore that is the same, similar, if not absolutely the same. Wood knocks being a great example. Almost every poltergeist case that you investigate, that you look at, has some kind of rapping, knocking, thumping, some kind of something inside the house, which, if you take it and you translate it out into the woods, becomes wood knocks very easily. over the course of doing the research and looking at all these poltergeist cases, the more I read about poltergeist cases, and that is a very deep well with a lot of rabbit holes in it. But the more I read about poltergeist cases in the psychical literature, the more I realized that you don't have to posit a bipedal primate wandering around in the woods to explain a lot of this Class B encounter stuff that's happening.
I believe the way Soraya looks at it, because I've been listening to the show for a while now, and the idea that he kind of came up with is that if it's in a house, they're going to call it a poltergeist. If it's in the
Right.
forest, it's Bigfoot.
We're going to
So
call
it's
it a
like, but
Bigfoot or
there's
a Sasquatch.
not,
Yeah.
but the phenomenon kind of acts the same, and it's not necessary. We're just using two different words for the same phenomenon, essentially.
I mean, and I would agree with him there. Now, I have said over and over again, because I know that I'm going to get somebody's knickers in a twist. I've said over and over again that I don't have any problem believing that there might be an actual giant bipedal primate wandering around in the wilderness. If you live in Canada, there's hundreds of thousands of miles of square miles of boreal forests and other environments
Oh,
that would
absolutely.
be, perfect phenomena for or perfect ecosystem for a large creature of that kind.
And
You know, there's plenty of food and so forth.
in your
So
book,
I'm not. Go
sorry.
ahead.
Well, you deliberately excluded British Columbia just because of the sheer amount of cases.
So I'm not. I want to make it clear to people that I'm not just. I'm not saying that. Oh well, the Sasquatch, these giant apes don't exist at all. It's all about poltergeist. What I am saying though is that if you look at all the Class A sightings, just the Class A sightings, just the where people have seen creatures, they're being seen in every state in the United States and every province in Canada, except for maybe none of it. They're everywhere. It's like, so if this creature is so rare that it's hard to find, why is it that people are seeing these things everywhere? The only place that I know of that doesn't have sightings is Hawaii, and they have something that might be like a Littlefoot in their spirit lore. I think it's called a Menehune or Menehune, something like that.
Right. Yeah.
But
That's right.
so at on the one hand, you have Sasquatch researchers saying, oh, well, this is a very rare bipedal primate that lives in, the wilderness. And then on the other hand, we have people seeing these things everywhere. So something's got to give here. There has to be something more operant in this mystery to explain all the sightings, and especially to explain all of the Class B encounters that people are having out in the woods. And I think this is where the idea of something like the forest poltergeist comes in, because not only is it a possibility that this force, this energy, this entity, or whatever you want to call it, is producing these effects out in the woods, but it may actually be reproducing some of the sightings too. I talk a little bit in the book about apparitions. And most people, when you talk about apparitions, their mindset is, ooh, the spooky graveyard and the misty figure walking through it, or the haunted house with the misty woman in white or whatever wandering through. If you look at books like Terrell's massive tome on apparitions, I can't remember his full name, TMN Terrell or something like that. But he wrote the book on apparitions, and that's what it's called, Apparitions.
Yeah,
The
I'm familiar with that
majority
book. Yeah.
of people or a lot of the people in that book, when they saw an apparition, thought they were seeing an actual person.
Right.
You wake up and there's somebody standing at the foot of the bed.
It's very
You know,
solid looking.
and these things were so real that they actually cast shadows, a lot of some of them. So it's entirely possible that, our force poltergeist, our energy or whatever it is that's operating out in the woods is producing apparitions and images, imitating maybe something that exists already, or that existed in the past or whatever.
It's an interesting concept there. Well, you're kind of dealing with like two unknowns, essentially. Things that like for science isn't necessarily proven either way. Poltergeist being one of them, ghosts, and the second one being Bigfoot. Is there some overarching intelligence that maybe knows that Bigfoot is actually out there and then appears as a Bigfoot, essentially? I mean, I think that's essentially kind of what you're saying, which I know, we've talked about your animistic beliefs, and that might, go into that a little bit,
Every culture, all of your indigenous cultures have some form of trickster. Which is all the time messing with people, messing with human beings, messing with other spirit beings and so forth. But we don't even have to go that far. I mean, I personally, I mean, one of the thought pieces in the book is, what if there is an energy that, either understands that there is an actual Sasquatch that lives in the deep forests of, United States and Canada, and uses that model as one of its ways of getting people's goats, I mean, just, having
Sure.
Sasquatch appear wherever and raising Cain, you get a reaction of some kind out of people when they see a Sasquatch, right? It's like,
I think it would
if nothing
explain,
else.
I think it would explain some of the sightings that you would see in the more populated eastern parts.
Or
I mean, I
in
think it,
places like San Antonio, Texas.
right.
I mean, there's actually a group that's investigating Sasquatch sightings in that area.
Yeah,
And
and that's not
again,
what you would
I
think.
never ever say that a
Yeah.
witness isn't telling the truth, but that's just not a place that a giant bipedal primate would live.
Yeah. No, you're
I
right.
grew up in San Antonio. I know that area really
Right.
well. There's no place to hide for an animal that size.
I
It's
couldn't see that happening here in Tennessee, you know.
But again, witnesses tell us that they're seeing these things. They're seeing something. I don't know what it is. It may be Sasquatch lives in caves in San Antonio somewhere. I don't know, but I find it far more likely that there's something more paranormal going on in places like that than an actual bipedal primate. Now, if you told me that you saw a Sasquatch and you were in Northern Ontario somewhere, I'd be like, okay,
Yeah,
I could buy
sure.
that. I mean,
Yeah, not
we
many
can
people.
lose bison out here for
Yeah.
decades. It's like I could see a giant ape living out there
Right,
too.
right.
So,
Wouldn't most
but.
Sasquatch sightings also be like thought of as fleeting, not as, some kind of prolonged visual confirmation? I know some people have longer experiences, but as far as the hierarchy of evidence, visual confirmation, we know just psychologically, you can think you see things that you necessarily don't, or your mind fills in the gaps and heuristics and things like that. But these the B type evidence are a lot of things that can be recorded or evidence that actually remains there to be looked at and possibly studied.
Yeah, the interesting thing, so to back up and talk about the A type site, there certainly are a significant number of Class A sightings that are, I was driving down the road and I passed a Sasquatch as I was driving down the road, and by the time I turned around, it was gone. On the other hand, though, you have any number of sightings of, by hunters out in the woods. And I'm thinking Canada again, because that's kind of
Yeah.
my place where I've done most of my research. Any number of sightings by hunters out in the woods who've, had pretty good visuals, actually had scope sightings of these creatures. So I don't think that we can Yes, I'm sure that a number, and I won't say a significant number, but some percentage of Class A sightings are misidentified animals, shadows that moved in a way that caused pareidolia and it caused people to see images. The human brain is designed to find patterns, and so. When it's presented with something that it doesn't necessarily recognize, it forms its own pattern. And people may, and I think that that's probably contingent on what you've got in your head and what you have available to actually create a pattern with. I mean, there certainly are some misidentifications. There's some folks that just got excited because they saw a bear or whatever, those kinds of things. But then there are, sightings by very credible witnesses with, pretty extensive observational training, that have taken place, at fairly good, fairly close ranges and so forth, where you really have to believe that this person saw something unusual, because they wouldn't be reporting it otherwise, because it could actually be dangerous to their careers. On the other hand, when you start talking about the Class B stuff, you get into a paradox because, yes, you have things that can be recorded with footprints. Footprints are a classic example. Everybody says, this is proof that Sasquatch exists. I hate to tell you this, kids, but it's not. It is not. It is proof that something left tracks. But some of those track finds are as puzzling as the existence of Sasquatch, because you'll have a track line that goes out into the middle of a cornfield and disappears. Or any of the or you have a single track. Why would you just have one? There's a single track found somewhere. Again, though, there are track ways. But what I point out in the book when I start talking about tracks is, when you go into the poltergeist lore, or even Freudian lore, there are any number of instances where these phenomena have left tracks of varying kinds, whether it's hoof prints. There's a famous case, Freudian case, of line of hoof type prints that were stomped all across. I think it was the Devon County in England back in the 1800s.
The devil's footprints.
The devil's footprints, very, very well known Freudian case that, there's all kinds of, there's, everybody's, oh, it's paranormal. And then there's the materialists who are all like, oh, it was a mouse or a kangaroo or something.
I think the best explanation I've heard for that was that it was some kind of weather measuring, like Victorian era measuring device that was a balloon. And
I haven't heard that one.
it had some kind of piece of metal on it, like a key or something, and some kind of piece of metal, and it would daub along, and it would leave the marks with the key, and then the wind would pick it up. It would, of course, blow out, and then the wind would go down and come back down, and the key would daub around a little bit. That's my favorite explanation for
That's kind of interesting
it.
because,
Well, that's one of those cases where
if
the
you read the
explanation seems
contemporary,
sillier than the actual
even
thing.
weirder than the actual event.
Yeah,
Because
right.
if you read the
Curious is weirder.
contemporary account, these hoof prints or these footprints or whatever you want to call them, actually, would go up to a house and then go up to the roof. And go across the roof and then down and on their way.
Yeah.
There's one instance where the prints were recorded going to a pipe, and then on the other side of the pipe, taking up taking up where they left off, and then it just kept going. I find it hard to believe that a balloon that was being blown around by the wind would have that much control, but. Yeah, it's one of those cases where the explanation is
Right,
weirder than the
right.
actual event.
Yeah. It's not a great
But
explanation.
There's one example of footprints in the Black Monk case that I cite pretty extensively in the book. There was all kinds of wild stuff happening in this house, but one of the things that was seen a lot were puddles of water that would form spontaneously. It was so bad that they actually called the local maintenance people and had them look at the house. They turned the water off and did all of this stuff and tried to find leaks in the pipes and couldn't find anything. But as that case was starting to wind down, the mother came downstairs one day, and there was a runner that went out to the front door, a carpet runner, and it was soaked. It was just absolutely soaking wet. And as she's standing there, she's watching as footprints appeared in this thing, going up toward the door. So again, there's an instance of a poltergeist leaving tracks. One of the classic methods of ghost hunting back in the day, before we had EMF meters and all this other fun stuff, is, if it was believed that a certain area was haunted, is the ghost hunters back in those days would put down a layer of flour,
Yep, or talcum
and come
powder or
back and
something like
see,
that.
yeah, or talcum powder or something like that, come back to see if if tracks manifested, during the night. And sometimes they did. I cite a case from Hans Holzer in the book where these folks had continuing, another one of the things that you see in Class B encounters a lot is this talk of people hearing bipedal footsteps. These folks had bipedal footsteps upstairs. They had two kinds of bipedal footsteps walking around in their houses. One sounded like an adult clomping around upstairs. The other sounded like what they described as small children running around. This haunting had gone on for some time, and the mother finally decided that she wanted to see if there was some proof of this, did the flower thing in one of the bedrooms, and came back to find little footprints, all in the flower.
That's a technique that's
Even,
still used. They still
yeah,
do
even this
that.
idea, yeah, even this idea, I think it's a great idea, yeah, sure, what else? Whatever. But even this idea that, Sasquatch leaves these giant prints, and we know, and there's, you've got Jeff Meldrum with all the stuff about bipedal locomotion and all that stuff. The fact is that a lot of the prints that people find out there are atypical. Yeah, a primate is supposed to have five toes, and any number of these mysterious footprints have three toes, and some of them have six toes. And yeah, I mean, a three-toed primate is not something that's supposed to happen. But if you posited that it was a more paranormal, for want of a better word, energy, then it can have however many toes it wants, because it's not necessarily corporeal. It's just able to produce these effects, right? So, I mean, and tracks are just one of many things that I talk about in the book. I talk about vocalizations and how, everybody's, all hep to the Sierra sounds, right? And all these wild noises that were recorded, and some of that stuff, I again, it was a it was a wilderness area, not heavily populated with a lot of people. There may have been Sasquatches out there, doing samurai chatter or whatever, all these other vocalization things. But the presence of vocalizations in an area doesn't necessarily definitely point to Sasquatch, because if you go to your poltergeist lore again, you find out that poltergeists are excellent mimics. There's reports of poltergeists making barn animal sounds, in the making well okay so there are barn animal sounds. We have reports of apparitions screaming. like really loudly enough to, set somebody back on their heels. So again, we have poltergeists making all kinds of different vocalizations, so to speak. I mean, I don't know that poltergeists have vocal cords, but they're making sounds. They're making really loud sounds sometimes. In a association with all of these raps and bangs and all this other fun stuff. People cite the idea of Sasquatches throwing stones. Everybody's like, well, bears don't throw rocks, and that's true. That's very true. And it may be that in some of these rock throwing incidents, there was a Sasquatch around. That there may be a bipedal primate running around throwing stones at people. Don't know. What I do know is that some of the experts on poltergeists, people like Playfair and Colin Wilson, cite stone throwing as one of the classic signs of poltergeist activity.
Yes, it is.
Playfair, Playfair, in one of his books, cites a case where a young lady was the focus of poltergeist activity in a home, and they tried to have her exorcised, and that didn't work. So the local spiritist, who happened to be a dentist, offered to take her into his home. And at after he did this, his house was bombarded with stones. I mean, literally, he kept count of the number of stones that actually hit his home, and it was well over 200 stones, right? So poltergeists love to throw rocks. Other cases that are cited in the book, we have Legos flying around, we have marbles flying around, we have all kinds of interesting, projectiles flying through people's homes. So the idea of that energy actually focusing out in the wilderness and producing stone throwing is not only that. Not only do we have testimony of things flying through the air in poltergeist cases, but we also have testimony of apports in poltergeist cases where things just appear and fall out of the sky. You could also have a situation where people are just having stones falling out of the sky on them and mistaking it for a stone being thrown at them. I mean, again, as I said, the deeper I got into the poltergeist lore, the more I realized that stuff and the stuff that's being described in Class B encounters, there's just so much similarity there that you can't ignore it.
It's interesting. I mean, I've heard the stones thing. I wonder if, because I was going to bring up the apport idea, and whether or not, because like the Legos and these type of things, these are things that are already there in the environment, and it's just the poltergeist is just manipulating this, whatever a poltergeist is, which we can kind of talk about that. But there is, the stone seems like it's just coming out of nowhere. And as you were talking, I'm kind of, reminiscent about the rains of stones and rains of frogs and these other odd
Oh, yes.
Fortiana type
Yeah,
things.
the ones that meteorologists are always trying to explain is a tornado came along and picked this stuff up and then dropped it
Oh,
on
yeah, cyclone,
somebody's neighborhood, right? It's like, oh, wow, that was a selective tornado. Because it only picked one kind of frog,
It just
or
picked up
one
these frogs.
or fish, or whatever it is.
I wonder about, is this stuff just being transported from somewhere else? Obviously, when you're in the woods type setting, there's going to be stones and things around, and you
Oh, yeah. All
do a good
kinds of
job of
stuff.
like pointing out, you do a good job of pointing out that also, that is kind of like primate behavior of throwing stones and these type of things. So it's not exactly that it could be a forest poltergeist, but that is a very classic poltergeist phenomenon of stone throwing and things coming out of nowhere, literal nowhere. Now, the Bell Witch, which I think you might have mentioned it a couple of times, but the Bell Witch is a little weird because it's there's so much folklore around it, but in that case, you've got you definitely have those same kind of apports and things coming out of nowhere. Supposedly,
Oh,
she
yeah.
get like fruit from the West Indies and these type of things. So, but the same thing, the manifestation of the voice, moving things around,
Cracks.
those type of things, raps and crap, you know. And you also point out in the book that this is how the spiritualism movement gets started, basically from a poltergeist, from the knockings,
Yeah, rampant.
at the Fox Sisters.
So Bell Witch is, I don't claim to be an expert on the Bell Witch case, but one of the things that I talk about in the track section is, again, the Bell Witch is supposed to have left tracks for the younger Bell son,
Right,
after
right,
father died.
right.
Again, left tracks in the snow. Something did that. We don't know what it was, but something did that.
The
So,
interesting
yeah.
thing about Bell Witch, too, is that initially some things start manifestation as animals,
Yes.
specifically a dog, I think, or a wolf, or something like that.
But yeah, it's very much the case, though, that if you start to look at these cases, that you realize that it absolutely could be an unknown force or entity or whatever operating in the woods. Because, just as easily as it could be a giant bipedal primate.
Well,
The other thing that I talk about is the whole nesting thing.
yeah, I was going to ask you about
People
that.
always saying, okay, we're finding these or structures, we're finding
Right.
these structures in the woods. One of the things that you see in poltergeist cases is that poltergeists love to rearrange their environment. Just absolutely love it. Now, sometimes that's most of the time, that's very destructive. They're breaking glass and shattering crockery and doing all that kinds of thing. But like I said, there's the one case in Olive Hill where William Roll saw this poltergeist actually take the dining room table, flip it upside down, and set it very carefully on top of the chairs so that it was positioned just so. I talk about a poltergeist case. I think it was from Colin Wilson's book, where the poltergeist delighted in making tableaus. It would take the clothes and various things that it found around the house and make these just lay them out so that like it represented a person praying or something like that as kind of a way of making fun of the people in the house, right? You have instances of poltergeists moving, armoires and things that weigh several hundred pounds. So this is a force that is very much capable of, bending tree branches and doing things with it, just as easily as a giant bipedal primate. We also talk about this whole idea, that people are finding, in areas that are supposed to have lots of Sasquatch activity, are finding these nest type areas as depressions that everybody gets excited about because they're thinking of gorillas, right? Because gorillas make these kinds of nests in their forest habitat as well. Then you get into, but again, you have a force that's capable of doing this kind of stuff, that shows that that has shown itself repeatedly to be very creative, not only in destroying things, but in actually creating things, rearranging things, moving things around, piling furniture on top of people, pinning them in place, but not injuring them.
Yeah, that was an interesting one that I never heard of before.
So it is not a beyond the realm of possibility that a force like that could create a clearing, nest type clearing out in the woods. And then you start to think about crop circles and things like that, and you're like, wait a minute. But I didn't go down that rabbit hole
Sure,
particularly. I
sure.
was trying to stay somewhat focused as I worked my way through the book.
Well, so one thing that That reminds me, is you talk about these kind of like the signs of, and I'm just, you know, quotations, signs of Sasquatch presence, kind of like what those are. One of those, sometimes people, when they have these sightings, they will have this like silence effect. And this is something that Jenny Randall's a UFO investigator, and this is in the UFO context that she writes this, but it's true of other encounters with other type of things. This idea of the Oz effect, and these things that happen before some of these Class A encounters and some of these Class B encounters. This is something
Exactly.
that's common.
Yeah, I dubbed it the silence because I don't think that it has an official name, but Jenny Randall's UFO researcher out of the UK wrote an article. She'd had a witness who was, if I remember correctly, was a security guard in a factory, and he'd had a full-blown UFO encounter, right? Lights, structured craft with lights and all this stuff outside of the place where he worked. And Randall's questioned the other guard who was on duty that night, and they saw absolutely nothing. She actually canvassed the neighborhood because, I mean, this was like a big, like you couldn't miss this kind of UFO sighting, right? Talked to people in the neighborhood, nobody saw anything. What she noted in talking to the witness was that he'd had an experience shortly before his sighting, something going on. He had a feeling something was going to happen, right? And then this silence drops in. It's an unnatural silence. Everything goes quiet. It's almost like the world outside of your bubble has become muted. And we see this a lot in Sasquatch encounters, where people talk about how the forest suddenly became, preternaturally quiet. There was no sound at all anywhere in the area. And part of that may be, the presence of what, I think most people would consider an apex predator. But a lot of people note that this just was not natural at all. There was no sound at all coming in, even from a distance. So you have the feeling that something's going to happen. You have this silence that descends on people, and then you have some kind of a time distortion, and that can be either the witness felt like a long time had passed, and then they looked at their watch and it was 5 minutes, or vice versa. They thought that only a few minutes had passed, and they look at their watch, and it's been 2 hours.
Missing
There's
time,
some
yeah.
kind of there's some, and it's not
Right.
even so much missing time. It's time is distorted. Now
Yeah.
you can have missing time in there as well. Yes.
You could have been standing there for 2 hours, you know.
Yeah, you could have been standing there
Yeah,
for 2 hours.
right.
But there's that idea of time distortion. But I talk about in the silences and that feeling of something going on, this kind of Oz effect that Randall talks about is something that you see in Sasquatch encounters. It's also something that, whether it's a Class A or Class B type encounter, and it's also something that you see sometimes in poltergeist activity, where the people who live in the house know that something's about to happen.
Yeah.
And then sometimes too, you get that silence effect where, everything suddenly gets quiet and then all hell breaks loose, and things start flying around and all that sort of thing. So again, this makes you think, when you're comparing Sasquatch and paranormal or the poltergeist kind of phenomena, this makes you think that there's something more going on than just a large bipedal ape. Because you do have instances of people reporting this Oz type effect in both circumstances. And then, you see it in all kinds of other, I mean, I'm sure that if I were to research, dogman cases, you'd have a certain percentage of those that were preceded by Oz type effects, any of the monster type stuff. UFO encounters, obviously, because that's what Randall's was basing her stuff on. People have these strange encounters, shadow people, that kind of stuff. People have these strange encounters, and it seems to be presaged by this weirdness that happens immediately before or during the event. And I don't think we can ignore this and just say, oh, well, that's neither here nor there. There's obviously a giant ape there, and it's creating all of this effect by infrasound. Yeah,
Yeah, I was
that's what
wanting
it
to
was.
ask you how you felt about the infrasound idea.
Well, okay. So, yes, it is true that, for instance, tigers are able to produce these low frequency sounds, and this seems to have an effect on freezing their prey and, making them.
I think house cats can do that
Yeah.
as well.
It's also true that elephants can communicate over
Yeah.
long, long distances using these ultra low frequency things. So, infrasound is a thing. It's also true that the United States military has been trying for some time to figure out how to use this as a weapon, because in certain instances, at certain frequencies, these low frequency sounds will cause sort of panic reactions, right?
Right.
So I don't, again, discount the idea of infrasound be having a place in some of the Sasquatch encounters and some of the things that people experience during Sasquatch encounters. For instance, it's very frequently the case that people have not frequently, I don't know how frequently, but it is the case that some people have kind of an extreme terror reaction to seeing one of these creatures. Now, I mean, honestly, if I ran across an 8 or 10 foot tall, bipedal primate in the woods, I think I'd probably freak out a little bit too.
Well,
I mean, it's not something you expect to see. It's not something that's supposed to exist. I mean, you have every reason to be scared because these things are, from all accounts, people have seen these things. They are freaking huge, and they are, they are so powerful and powerful looking that, it becomes very evident to any puny human that's looking at one of these things that it could, snap you in half and carry the parts off in each hand. They're very large creatures, according to almost all witness statements, right? I don't know that we need to explain the extreme terror reaction with, infrasound. It could be. It could be.
well, if Bigfoot Sasquatch is somewhere on the human primate evolutionary tree, to my knowledge, I don't think there's any other primates that would that use that infrasound.
Yeah, and that's the counter argument right there
Right.
is I'm not aware of a primate that uses infrasound
Yeah.
for hunting, communication, or anything else. About as close as you come is gorillas using the deep thumping for
Right,
communication
right, right.
across some distance, thumping on their chest and so forth. And chimpanzees pound the ground
Yeah.
to do that as well. And I think gorillas do too. So, infrasound, yeah, possibility. The problem is that, again, and this is something that some of our the people that we've talked about in the past have mentioned is that, the materialist researchers on Sasquatch are so intent on proving that this is an animal that they've given it evolutionary advantages that you just it's might you might as well have might as well say that Sasquatch is an Avenger, right?
Yeah,
You
it's on
know,
the verge of
apparently,
supernatural.
apparently this creature is this huge creature, this 8 foot tall, several hundred pound ape is capable of, almost disappearing into the forest, just blending into the forest, without any difficulty whatsoever. It's able to move silently when it desires to. It has infrasound so that it can befuddle your mind and disappear. You get all of this stuff, and it's like, okay, why don't we just say that it's a paranormal creature? Because it sounds like it. It sounds like it has superpowers.
They're trying to fit it into
Well, yeah, I mean,
the
they're
a
trying to
materialist kind of box.
fit it into, biological reality, and I respect that. I respect the hell out of the people that go out in the woods and look for this thing. They spend a lot of time and effort and money and blood, sweat, and tears out there, trying to prove the existence of this creature. I have nothing but respect for those guys and women, just to be, equality and everything. So many of them are just, it's we're trying to prove there's a new species out there, and they're not willing to look at, they're not willing to step out of the Sasquatch research silo and look at the mysteries overall. And this is one of the points that I make in the book. It's like there is a definite silo effect in the paranormal. You have Sasquatch researchers who think that everybody who researches other stuff like ghosts and UFOs is nuts. You have the UFO researchers who are, this is their thing. There are things in the sky and there are aliens and there's all this stuff. The ghost hunters, you have the ghost hunter. Yeah, I don't even want to get into that one. You have the ghost, you don't want to hear my opinion about aliens, but you have ghost hunters who are like, okay, there are ghosts and there's hauntings and there's all this stuff, and we don't care about any of this other stuff. It's not until you take a Freudian perspective and you look at all of this weird crap, whether it's Sasquatch or UFOs or, rains of blood and flesh from the sky, until you get into that Freudian perspective and you look at all of this strange stuff put together, that you can say, oh, wait, this stuff is kind of like this stuff. Gosh, I wonder if there could be some kind of a connection there.
If we're dealing with an overarching phenomenon that we just
We just
interpret
don't
as
understand.
separate things.
Well, yeah, and this is one of the things that I've discussed with Soraya, amongst many other things. If you've ever listened to one of our rambling episodes, we almost always end up doing two parts because we get going on something. But one of the things that we talk about is that idea that the human brain has a storehouse of images, and you encounter an energy, let's call it an energy, out in the woods, and your brain is trying to figure out what the hell this is. And it's going to pull up whatever image it can to try and put a form to whatever this energy is that you've encountered. So, a good example of this, I didn't put a form to it, but I've talked about this in other interviews. Excuse me. I was hiking in Arizona in the Superstition Wilderness, which is kind of a high strangeness kind of place anyway. I never had anything super weird happen to me there, but I have been hiking in that area. And walked into the mouth of a little arroyo or a canyon type thing. And I got about two steps into this thing, and in my perception, it suddenly got much darker. This is Arizona, full daylight in desert. It doesn't get dark. There is no dark because there are no clouds. Suddenly, in my perception, it gets much darker. And I have that feeling of, okay, I don't belong here. I should not be here. This is not a good place for peoples to be. And being aligned more in the animistic idea of everything's places having spirits. I was like, well, whatever this is, it doesn't want me here. So I backed up the two steps, and as soon as I was outside of this canyon, the sunlight came back, everything returned to normal. And there was a slight, I didn't have the full-blown silence effect, but it did get quieter as I walked into this thing. And I imagine that if I had walked farther back in there, I probably would have gotten into a full-blown Oz effect kind of experience. But I was like, nope,
Ended up in
sorry.
one of David Paulides'
Sorry
books.
to disturb you. Now, my mind didn't try to form an image there, but I could see where someone could, walk into that same situation and see a monster,
Sure.
because their brain was trying to make sense of what was going on. So yeah, I mean, when we step outside of the silos and get into the more Freudian viewpoint of things, it opens possibilities out almost endlessly. And that's kind of what I talk about in the second half of the book, where I propose, a number of different ways that this whole forest poltergeist thing could work, ranging from strictly human abilities, that whole RSPK thing that that the parapsychologists talk about. It's random spontaneous psychokinesis, which they use as a kind of a quote unquote explanation of the poltergeist phenomena.
Right. Whereas this Bigfoot phenomena doesn't have that kind of thing often attributed to it, but it does have this convenient material explanation that's super creative that regular poltergeist phenomena doesn't have. Like with the RSPK stuff, the only other ones are like whether it's there's natural phenomena or a hoax. But Bigfoot has a super creative materialist thing to explain all this stuff, whereas Poltergeist doesn't.
So, but if you take this and spin it around on its head a little bit, the parapsychologists have theorized that certain people, usually very repressed people, people who aren't expressing their emotions for whatever reason, sometimes prepubescent, but not all the time. That's kind of a myth that people have been led to believe, because there have been focuses of poltergeist activities who were in their 20s and older. But this person is typically repressed, unable to express their emotions, and they have what Lloyd Auerbach refers to as a psychic temper tantrum, which is what produces, according to the parapsychologists, produces this poltergeist activity. Now, think about this for just a minute. If you take this out in the wilderness, okay, and I use the example of, some hikers who are having relationship problems, but I also use the example of somebody who's filming a television show about Bigfoot. They need something to happen, right? They need, for some kind of activity to manifest in order to keep their show going, right? I mean, that's the nature of the beast. So there's a certain level of frustration, maybe, if nothing's going on in the woods that night. I could see where you might have somebody in that group of people who manifests this RSPK and produces some kind of results that they can go off and chase in the woods. 'Cause you notice that these things happen. They'll get bangs, they'll get howls, they'll get rock clacks or stones thrown at them or whatever. And then, they go running off in the woods with their cameras and all this stuff, right? And they're pounding around out there, and the rest of the night is quiet, because they had that one spontaneous event. Could just as easily be an RSPK outbreak as it as a big hairy guy wandering around the woods throwing stones at people. But since you have a nice materialist, it is a bipedal ape explanation, people are you know, who are raised in the scientific materialist paradigm from the time they're, you know, in first grade, are going to have an easier time believing that than thinking about, you know, again, slipping into the Fordian model and looking at all the other weird stuff out there and saying, oh, look, there might be connections from here to here. you know, and again, you know, I'm not saying that there isn't a giant bipedal primate, but I'm saying that that's not all there is. There's, you know, plenty of other things that we can look at. You know, well, there was the whole film experiment thing where they actually created a ghost.
Right. I was gonna ask you about that, about the tulpa.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah.
The tulpa yeah. effect, where you could actually essentially create Bigfoot. I'll go back to this, you know, something that Timothy Renner pointed out to me. One of the places I've been to a couple of times, there's a Bigfoot museum in North Georgia, Expedition Bigfoot. And
right.
North Georgia is known for having some sightings, but you have this huge, basically Tim likened it to a temple to Bigfoot, essentially. It's basically a shrine to Bigfoot. Well, sure enough, people have had encounters. People have seen Bigfoot cross the road multiple times. Now, did this happen before, or did this happen? It seems like it's happened after. And it's almost like that energy has created these manifestations.
Well, sure. I mean, okay, so I'm kind of allergic to the tulpa word because
that's a little overused nowadays.
Yeah.
Well, not only is it overused, but it's actually a word that's a specific Tibetan word. That frames a particular style and type of meditation that they do, which has the effect of creating what Western occultists call a thought form.
Right.
And so I typically refer to them as thought forms, but yeah, it's very much the same thing. You know, you have John Keel telling us that that the fellow who wrote the Shadow radio show, his house apparently is haunted by a figure that looks like the Shadow. You have Alan Moore,
yeah.
Who swears that he actually ran into Constantine in a coffee house in London.
Yeah,
you know, he saw. Yeah. He said it wasn't, you know, it wasn't someone dressed like him. It was actually John Constantine.
He's like, it wasn't so, Sting. It wasn't, which he did base John Constantine off the way he looked off of Sting, but yeah.
Right. You know, you have, you know, things like this whole Slenderman phenomena where a whole bunch of people got together, created this thing. They've been pouring energy into it for, you know, God knows how long, scaring the crap out of each other with it, right? And now people are starting to see it and actually, you know, respond to it and think that it's communicating with them and doing all this fun stuff. You know, the human mind is capable of doing a lot more than we think it's capable of. And, you know, so it's entirely possible, you know, and we go back to the Philip experiment where they actually sat in a sort of seance kind of thing, and they created this whole history for this being. And when it finally manifested and started rapping on tables, again, wood knocks, when it started rapping on tables and communicating with them, it actually started to expand its backstory. So it had taken on a mind of its own.
Right.
So, you know, you have hundreds of thousands of people who are obsessed with Bigfoot, right? With this whole Sasquatch phenomena. And they have a very specific idea of what this being looks like, right? So you have an image, you have desire, you know, and you have all of this energy pouring into this image. So, you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised if we haven't managed to create an apparition of a giant bipedal ape that's, you know, accounts for some of the sightings and some of the weird activity that people experience out in the woods. That's another distinct possibility. And that's not even, and that's just human originated activity. When you go into to fairy lore, you can get into a completely different kind of idea where these beings that we have had relationships with over the millennia, that we have acknowledged as being a part of the spiritual ecosystem of the places that we live, whether we're indigenous people or Celtic people or people from Russia, these beings respond to a certain set of rules, basically. And if you look at, I'm most familiar with Celtic fairy lore. If you look at some of the stories from Ireland, back in the day when people were still very intensely involved in the fairy faith, if you were going to build a house, before you built the house, they would set out piles of stones, and then they would put, I believe they put an offering out, and then they put a smaller stone atop the pile of stones. And they would check it the next morning to see if any of those stones had moved. And if any of those stones had moved, the idea, again, kind of a poltergeisty effect, right? If any of the stones had moved, then the fear was that the house was being was going to be located along a fairy path, one of the pathways that the fair folk took to move from one place to another. And they would not build on that on that site. It's also well known that if you did happen to have a house that was on one of these paths, there was frequently poltergeist type activity happening in the house. And the only way to stop that was to either change the configuration of your house. In one story, the guy actually takes the corner off of the building, which is where the path is supposed to run. He consults with the local wise person, and they tell him what to do. He actually takes the corner off. Other times, people have had to abandon their houses completely because this effect, this poltergeist effect, not only was affecting them, but it was also causing their children to sicken and die. So it's very much the case that, if you look at these, at fairy lore, that the fair folk are very much capable of not only these sort of poltergeisty activities, but actually physically manifesting in our world, to the point where it's said that the people actually interbred with them. You have to have a physical form to be able to do that kind of stuff. And physical forms leave tracks and do all kinds of other things. And one of the things that the fair folk are most known for is shape-shifting. Taking the forms of horses and dogs and cats
Oh
and
yeah,
all kinds of other
absolutely.
things.
Yep.
Who's to say that Bigfoot isn't actually a fairy?
Well,
I mean, when you take it
don't.
to its furthest, logical extent, it's entirely possible that Sasquatch is a species of fae.
And Joshua Cutchin, I mean, and Tim Renner, they've definitely talked about that in the Where the Footprints End books. But essentially, some of the native ideas about Sasquatch, essentially, I mean, that's essentially what Sasquatch is. It's non-corporeal. It doesn't exist. It comes and exists in our world for a little bit, then goes away. And I mean, essentially, that is the fairy realm.
Yeah, I mean the native people, the thing that pops to my mind when I talk about this is Linda Godfrey talks about in her books on man wolf slash dog man phenomena. She also talks a little bit about Sasquatch in those books, in some of those books. And she had conversations with elders of the Ho-Chunk tribe in Wisconsin, who told her, "Hey, look, the Sasquatch thing is actually a being that lives in the other world, the spirit world, or whatever you want to call it. It's capable of coming through into our realm and assuming a physical form, you know, so it can leave footprints and do all those things that Sasquatch does, and then it goes back. You know, and this would account for why it's so damn hard to track one down, right? They don't leave bodies laying around or any of that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I find that entirely believable. I've had conversations with people in magical occult communities who've had very much the same theory about some of these other things that people are seeing, like dog men. You know, there are certain beings who live in the other world who have the ability to walk through and gather what occultists call etheric substance to themselves, which is the kind of the framework around which our physical reality is built, gather this substance to themselves, assume a corporeal form, a physical form while they're here. But then as soon as they get to, as they go back, they release that substance and return to a non-corporeal state. So, I mean, it's as good a theory as any. And, you know, certainly you could call that, you know, the fairy realm or the fair folk or whatever. But I think that we have to acknowledge that, you know, and this is the animist in me coming out, that we live in a vast ecology amongst a vast ecology of spiritual beings, some of whom may be capable of doing this kind of thing. And the thing that manifests as Sasquatch may be one of those things. That would also account for why, you know, you get some of these weird reports of Sasquatches just disappearing in front of people. I in Sasquatch, Canada, I have a story where fellows, native fellow, indigenous fellow, was driving down the road in Yellowknife, up in the Northwest Territories, and he saw a Sasquatch on the side of the road. So, you know, he was interested. He slowed down so he could watch this thing. And as he's watching this creature walk along, is like a power line cut. He's watching this creature walk along. Suddenly, the Sasquatch starts to fade.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes more and more insubstantial until it just finally disappears. Now, you can't explain that with infrasound. You know, one of the theories of hearing Sasquatches is that the Sasquatch is zapping people with infrasound and then it runs off in the woods, right? You can't explain a sighting like that with infrasound. You know, because he had his eye on this creature the entire time and watched it disappear. You know, and there's the famous case from Stan Gordon's books where the lady thinks that she hears something out on the porch, scoops up her shotgun because she's had feral dogs in the area, walks out onto the front porch, and there's a 7-foot Sasquatch standing out there. It kind of rears back like it's surprised to see her and throws its hands up, right? And she blasts the thing with a shotgun and it disappears in a flash of light. Now, again, that's not something a physical creature does. You know? So, you know, I think that my whole point in writing this book and talking about these things is that the set, you know, much like Tim Renner and Joshua Cutchin did with Where the Footprints End, my whole point is that there's something much stranger going on in Sasquatch world than just a giant bipedal ape. That could Definitely. Be part of it. That could be part of it. And I don't deny that, you know, like I said, we lost, you know, wood bison in Canada for several decades before they found them again. You know, if you can lose the largest land animal by weight in North America for a few decades, then you can lose a Sasquatch in the Canadian woods too. But I don't think that's all that's going on. There's just so much weirdness around the whole Sasquatch phenomena with the,
oh, yeah,
the classic and all that stuff. I don't buy that that as the single explanation, which is why I'm always saying that I'm a both and thinker, because you know I'm perfectly willing to admit that there might be an ape out there, but I think there's other stuff going on as well.
In this book, you even tackle the whole demon question, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah,
kind of going back to the presentation you did for us back in last year.
Yeah, it's not demons. Sorry, kids, it's not demons.
What do you you know, there's a whole there's this whole culture now that's embraced Bigfoot, and one of those is there's a lot of evangelical Christians that have embraced the Bigfoot stuff, but they view Bigfoot in this, I guess, quote unquote biblical way of saying that Bigfoot is like the he's the Nephilim and all this.
Yeah.
Maybe he showed up in Miami a few days ago, but you know.
So I talked about briefly, because you know, again, this is not a subject of huge interest to me. But
right, right.
I felt like I needed to include something in the book about the whole demon thing, just because it is such a common trope in paranormal right now. It's like, you know, something blows its nose in the woods, or you know, blows its nose in your house, and it's demons. You know, and
well, you can really thank funny. You can thank Ed and Lorraine Warren for that. Okay,
you can thank them. Don't get me started on that one. I know some people from the magical world that'll give you an earful about Ed and Lorraine Warren.
I'm sure. I'm sure.
And some of the questionable iffy crap that they got involved in. But anyway, you know, and again, not my place to run somebody down, and you know, I'm sure that there are plenty of fans of those folks out there. I just don't happen to be one of them. So Nephilim, actually, you know, the whole concept of Nephilim is based in, you know, some very short verses in Genesis. The vast majority of the information that we have about the Nephilim actually comes from a couple of non-canonical books, scriptures, the books of Enoch. I think there are three of them, if I remember right.
Yeah, but I think the first one is the only one that really mentions it. Really yeah, talks about it. I think the other two are more poetic writings, I think.
Yeah, but you know, the theory is that you know, a group of angels, and you know, the evangelicals like to say that they're demons because they came to Earth, and angels apparently aren't supposed to live here and hang out with human females and interbreed. Which is apparently what happened according to the Book of Enoch, and that short verse in Genesis, which, you know, again, I couldn't even begin to quote to you. It's not my area of expertise, but you know, apparently the idea is that there was an interbreeding between human and angelic energies, and you know, produced this giant race. Now, how you make the jump from this giant race of humans, basically, to Sasquatch, I'm not sure. Because
they're tall.
Where did we get the fur from? In the first place, where did we get the fur from? You know,
there's also another
giant human beings, right?
Right. There's also another idea that Esau, you know, the brother of Jacob, was a Bigfoot. That's another one that I've heard. That's because, you know, he's hairy. You know,
I mean, whatever, folks. You know, I mean, whatever floats your boat. I'm not a biblical scholar. I don't pretend to be a biblical scholar. I probably know more about the Bible than some of the people that are spouting it. But you know, it's not my area of expertise. It's not something I'm particularly interested in. You know, I don't make any claims to follow the book or any of that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, I mean, there are people out there that are trying to equate Sasquatch with the Nephilim, and I think it's a heck of a reach. But you know, I mean, if you did have a group of beings that had come about as the result of a human angelic interbreeding, and over the course of time they evolved and evolved this hairy coat and you know went off into the woods and you know lived their own little Sasquatchy lives, it would account for some of the weird powers that have been assigned to Sasquatch, I guess. So you know it's not completely beyond the realm of possibility. I just You know, so much of it relies on, you know, believing in some book that I'm not, you know, it's not high on my list of things to account for as far as you know, Sasquatch goes. You know, same with demons. If you look at sources that are older than the Bible, you still see that there is a certain type of malignant spirit which really seems to have it in for human beings, that appears to be capable of, you know, very poltergeisty kinds of phenomena, right? Poltergeists sometimes get confused with demons because they get ticked off and do anti-Christian things like the Black Monk. They tried to exorcise him and he took on a very anti-Christian sort of pattern after that, which you know, if you had some of these folks out there, evangelical types would look at this as, oh, that's a demon. No, you just ticked off a poltergeist. But you know, so demons are capable apparently of doing, you know, I talk a little bit about this in the book, are capable of doing some of these sort of poltergeisty things, moving things around and that sort of thing. But I just don't see demons as an explanation for a lot of the Class B phenomena out there because their whole thing appears to be, you know, obsessing people, possessing people, that kind of thing. So where would a predatory spirit live? It would live where there are people, right? Where there's prey. It wouldn't be hanging out in the wilderness. If it was pursuing somebody, then I would think that it could think of something far more scary to do than rap on trees and you know make bipedal footsteps around somebody's tent. I just don't buy you know demons as being any kind of an explanation for Class B phenomena at all.
Sure.
Anything is possible. But they're much better candidates for, you know, as far as the you know spirits go, they're much better candidates like the fair folk
Yeah.
for Class B encounters than demons. So,
I think demons are just a matter of perspective, really. I mean, I think it's just,
well,
you know.
yeah, I mean, there are clearly, you know, going all the way back to Mesopotamia and Assyria and so forth, they're clearly they encountered and wrote about and developed magical methods of dealing with these malignant spirits that really seem to have it in for human beings. You know, I don't even know that you can call them demons, you know, because the word demon actually comes from the Greek daimon, which was basically just a spirit. There were,
Right.
you know, Agatha daimon and there were Kaku daimon, you know, the good ones and the bad ones. You know, it might be more appropriate to call them devils or something. I don't know. But, yeah, I didn't want to spend a lot of time talking about this stuff because I felt there was much more interesting
Sure.
stuff to talk about.
Yeah,
But I felt
absolutely.
I had to at least address it because somebody somewhere
He's
in an
gonna say
interview
something.
was going to ask me
Yeah.
about that, right?
Right.
Particularly if there was the you know if I were talking to some ghost hunters or something, somebody would ask me about that. So I figured I needed to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, Travis, I mean, this has been a very interesting interview. I really enjoyed speaking with you about this.
Enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
Yeah, very much so.
Oh,
I
I'm glad you enjoyed
flew
it.
through this book. I really did. It really held my attention, and it's a subject that I really, I mean, poltergeists are fascinating in and of themselves.
Oh, yeah.
But this I think was a book I think that did kind of need to be written. Somebody needed to kind of collate this and make these comparisons. So where can people find the book, and where can people find you? And there's got to be a next project, because you're almost at Nick Redfern level right now. You're almost
Oh,
there.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, Nick's got dozens and
Or
dozens of
maybe at
books out.
least Joshua
I've got like
Cutchin
5 hours.
level of book releasing.
As far as where the book can be found, it's available on Amazon. If you have, it's available as a paperback if you want to order paperback. It's also available as a Kindle. It's on Kindle Unlimited. If you subscribe to that service, you can get the book and you can read it right away. As far as where to find me, I'm available on, three of the big social media sites, WT Watson author page on Facebook, or if you want to contact me personally, it's Will Watson. On Twitter, I'm at WT Watson 2, and on Instagram, I have an old handle that I used. It's at Kurunir, Kurunir 60. I don't post Instagram as much as I do to the other two, mostly because I'm not much of a photographer, but every once in a while you'll see something, or I'll put a book cover up or something along that line. I should be more active there. As far as projects, I am working full time and trying to write at the same time. This one kind of took it out of me, so I'm probably going to take a little time to regroup. I'm looking at two different things. I'm thinking about expanding the It's Not Demons presentation into a book.
Okay.
And
Excellent.
I'd also like to write something about the silence, more along the lines of Mysteries in the Mist. So, I'll surprise you. All
Well,
right.
it goes to show that there's a lot to explore still in
Oh yeah. Oh
a lot of
yeah.
these
Oh yeah.
areas.
I will never, this is my passion. I will never run out of topics to write about. Ever.
Yeah. You are well needed in this field for sure.
And you're on
People
a
like
roll.
yourself.
Well, yeah. This is what let's see. Phantom Black Dogs, then there was Mysteries in the Mist, and there was Canadian Monsters and Mysteries, Sasquatch Canada, The Forest Bold. So this is my fifth book now.
Yeah,
So
good. Yeah, that's excellent. That's awesome. That's good.
For people who actually read The Forest Poltergeist and like it, there's lots of other stuff for you to dig into too.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Travis. Stay on the line for us. We're just going to close out the show. Guys, it's great to be back. We've got a looking forward to the new year and the year to come,
Yes,
despite all the
sir.
craziness that might happen. We're going to have a actually releasing a Patreon. It's kind of a short
Yes.
one, but it's going to be there at some point in the next week or so. And Serfiel can tell you if you want to support us, where you can go to do that if you so desire.
You can go over to patreon.com/conspiranormal. And thanks everyone for sticking in with us and supporting, even though we haven't been delivering too much Patreon content. But that is, looks like that's changing. We've got some plans to just do some simple, fun conversations, commentary on goings on in the paranormal conspiracy worlds to get our perspective on stuff that we necessarily don't want to give an entire show's attention to. But that's over at patreon.com/conspiranormal.
All right, guys. We will be back soon next week. Recluse will be returning, and then we will be coming back with other guests after that. So stay tuned on Conspiranormal.